Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
It's not just something you made. It's the privilege that you get to work with your hands. It's building something that serves a purpose. Proof that you have the grit to keep going. At Timberland, we understand you take your craft seriously, and we do too, which is why our products are built to the highest quality. We put in the work so you can perfect yours, with purpose in every detail and crafted with intention. Timberland, built on craft. Visit Timberland.com to shop.
The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. You can't get just one. Okay, so that's not like some marketing hyperbole. You literally can't get just one. They come in twos. So like, if you want just one, you're going to need to find a friend who loves slow-roasted chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch sauce. Or a friend of a friend, or have an awkward conversation with a complete stranger to see if they're obsessed with chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch. Or you could just like eat them both because you're obsessed with slow-roasted chicken, bacon. Okay, you get the idea. The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. At participating Taco Bell U.S. locations for limited time while supplies last.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it three times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
That part's 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Welcome back to another Western Rookie Podcast brought to you by Go Hunt. I'm your host, Brian Krebs, and today I have Jake Mertu on the call. Jake's from Iowa, and we're chatting a little bit about the green screen, how, you know, Jake, you're from Northwest Iowa, and we're talking about where, like, all the big bucks are famous in Iowa, and I don't know, my opinion has always been every place in Iowa is great. I mean, the whole state's got giants, and so Northwest, Southeast, I don't think it matters too much. And it sounds like that's kind of what you were seeing too. You know, maybe not quite as many deer, but still a lot of great bucks, as evidenced by your backdrop as well, by the way.
Yeah, no, it's there's big bucks everywhere in Iowa, like you said, but EHD's really hurt us the last few years, especially where I bow hunt. The mature buck population's really gone down. But like I said, you put in your patience, do your homework, and yeah, you'll find one.
So quick on the EHD, yeah, this is a Western podcast, but we do see some EHD popping up in the Dakotas and some mule deer populations around. I've never had a family, none of our family farms, our new farmstead, none of them have ever had an issue with really any disease, especially EHD. From what I gather, it gets worse in droughts, and it has something to do with like how the deer are getting at like water and ponds. And what's the kind of, I mean, put it in your own terms for someone that's like really not familiar much with EHD.
I basically heard the same thing you have. Seems to us to be worse in drought years, and in Iowa, at least my part of the state, it's been 3 years of drought right now. So we actually dodged it the first year, 3 years ago, when a lot of people were getting it around the state. These last 2 years, man, just, you know, checking trail cameras and doing that kind of thing, you find just, you know, you'll find them without actually looking for them. They're usually creek banks, pond shores, that type of thing. You'll find them. And it's a sad deal. And it seems to hit the mature bucks worse than anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I can feel that. So I found two deadheads on the farm this year on our new farmstead. So we barely shed hunted it. We didn't, I'm sure you know, we had a crazy winter. No snow, super warm. The last end of the rut and the late season hunting was terrible. And so I didn't really do much shed hunting. You know, our farm is a lot of low ground, especially. So I was really banking on like heavy winters, bringing them into the farm site here with the food plots, and hopefully like finding them on a haystack. Or following the trails in the snow across frozen swamp. That never happened. By the time they dropped, the swamp was boggy and wet and muddy. And we tried shed hunting a little bit, but I did find two deadheads by doing some habitat management, clearing some trails. And I'm so torn about it because it's cool to find deadheads, right? I like bucks. I like antlers. Mm-hmm. One of them was this crazy genetic deer, super tight, but had like triple split brows on one side, double split brows on the other side. And he was dead a long time. We moved in last summer, and he's been dead for 3-4 years. So that one didn't bother me as much. But the other one, I was walking the property with my father-in-law, and I found an 8-pointer that we had pictures of last fall. And he was in a spot where I don't think he's been dead very long. Like, he's still got some fur on his nose. I've been walking that trail. Like, I put that trail in January. I've probably walked it 6-8 times. Me and my wife have walked it. And all of a sudden, this very last time in April, I was like, oh, dang. There's a buck right off the trail. And it, sure enough, it's him. And that one hit hard because I had pictures of him. He was an up-and-coming 2-year-old. I was super excited for my wife to maybe get a shot at him, or maybe myself in a future year. And you're like, well, dang it. It's like, I like finding deadheads, but I don't want to find any more, at least not in my area. Like, I'll go find some public land deadheads in the Dakotas and bring those home.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's never any fun. Like I said, we found quite a few, and it's just disheartening because, you know, you find a lot of good up-and-comers, and you're like, man, those were the deer I was banking on for the next few years, you know, next 2-3 years to hunt. And then when you find those dead, you're like, you get worried, you know, you get worried of what's going to be out there the next year. And like I said, this last year, we only had, you know, a couple mature deer that I would even shot. And, you know, I was lucky to get one of them. But, you know, in other years, you know, you got 6, 7, 8 different mature deer to shoot. And it's just kind of, it's been slim pickings lately.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been tough for me. I haven't even shot a whitetail buck in 4 or 5 years. No, 4 years. 2019 was the last whitetail buck I shot, just because I try to pass some of the little ones. I like watching them grow so much.
Yep.
And but yeah, I usually just, we've been having that 1 or 2 hit listers to chase. And I think my niece shot one, which is good for her. 2 years in a row, I passed like some borderline ones that were really tough to pass. And then this last year, we had a giant, and I had him at 200 yards in shotgun zone.
Yep.
And so now I'm going to be switching to a long-range muzzleloader for shotgun zone here in Minnesota, because that's legal. Can you have a scope?
Yep.
There's 2 300-yard muzzleloaders out there now. That was the final straw. I've had it happen twice now, and now it's like no more. Next time this happens, yep. I switched farms. Now I'm hunting like a CRP farm that used to be just a pheasant farm for our family.
Yep.
And I started deer on that because we started getting some more and more bucks on it, and that's where that giant was. And then sure enough, the neighbor shot him with a muzzleloader.
That's how it always happens. We used to, a few years back, we hunted a big farm down in southern Iowa that was mostly CRP. And I tell you what, them deer, you know, you could sit on the road, and right before dark, they would just pop up out of that CRP grass.
Yeah.
And just like ants, and would just start filtering out of it. It's amazing cover.
It's crazy where deer, like, you can be looking all day and there's nothing. And all of a sudden there's just deer everywhere. And there's nowhere for them to hide. Like, it doesn't make sense. Like, you think you should be able to see them coming from any direction. And all of a sudden, boom, they're there. So that part's crazy. So hopefully this year's better. I'm excited because we're adding a few new hunts to the schedule this year that we've never done before. So my wife wants to get into Western hunting, and so we're doing an antelope hunt in Wyoming.
Oh, man. She'll have fun.
I'm excited. We just got her a new rifle. She's part of the Creedmoor Club now. We should get shirts or hats or something. But she's part of the Creedmoor Club, and it's not because of we've drank the Kool-Aid by any means. Everyone's got their opinion on calibers, right? And I don't really care what other people's opinions are. I don't think you should care about my opinion. I'm not a huge fan of the Creedmoor.
Yep.
I feel like it's a great target rifle at 1,000 yards. In hunting situations, I'm not a long-range hunter. You know, under 500 yards, there's better calibers out there in that medium game size. The problem is she's left-handed. And she just won a bow at our archery banquet for our league. They gave away free tickets for their general raffle, and she won a bow. So we're like, well, you're already shooting an awesome Hoyt, brand new Hoyt.
Yep.
So you already probably got a nicer bow. So, and it was a right-handed bow. And so we traded it in. She's going to get a left-handed rifle. Well, there's only like four main options. This will be good information for anyone out there that's got left-handed someone in the family. They're looking for rifles. It basically came down in our budget and what we wanted to do with a lighter weight hunting rifle to a Ruger American, a Browning X-Bolt, a Tika T3 Lite, or maybe a Bregera B14. But that one was getting a little too heavy. She didn't want a heavy gun. And I know there's like Weatherby Vanguards and Christensen Arms out there, but those are way out of our, you know, she wasn't going to spend that much money. Well, so we go to the shop, and I'm like, hey, I want a 270 left-handed X-Bolt. And they're like, good luck. We don't even order left-handed rifles anymore from Browning because they always cancel the order. And to be quite frank, if we can't find one in stock anywhere with our distributor network, you're not going to get one this year. So I'm like, well, what's in stock? And he goes, I don't have any Ruger Americans. I don't have any Tika T3s. The only thing I have in stock is a left-handed 308 X-Bolt or a left-handed 6.5 Creedmoor X-Bolt. And I'm like, I guess she's getting a Creedmoor then. And so we ordered it, and it was there in 2 days.
Yep.
And so that's why she joined the Creedmoor Club. But I don't know. I'm kind of excited. I mean, it's going to be perfect for antelope and deer. I know a lot of people, like, the biggest question on the forums right now is the Creedmoor enough for elk? And half the people say not even close, and the other half of the people say I shot this bull at 500 yards.
I was going to say that when you talk to Creedmoor guys, it's either you're way out in right field or you're way out in left field. There's, like, no in between. It is you either love it or you hate it. So,
yeah
it's
we'll see. She'll take it elk hunting for sure.
Yep.
It'll probably be I'll have to look at the ballistics and the bullets we pick out of it. I'm thinking like 300, maybe 350. I mean, I don't even like shooting 400 yards. And I have a long-range 300 windbag on a, you know, a modified chassis rifle, huge scope. Like, and I've taken a 5 and a 540 shot, both animals I brought home. But I'm like, I'm not having fun at that range. I'm like, all right, the wind is calm, everything's calm, I'm going to do this, but I wish it was 250. Like, that's always what I'm thinking. Like, I wish I didn't get pinned down here at 500 yards or 540 yards. Yep. 540 was an elk, 500 was a mule deer. But if she needed to shoot, like, 400, 425, she could just use my rifle at that point.
Yeah. I'm living here in Iowa, we don't even have a rifle season. You know, we're kind of getting into some straight-walled rifle during deer season. But, I mean, generally, 100 yards is the furthest we shoot during any given shotgun season. Well, I went, you know, I shot my antelope at like 281 this year, and I felt like it was a mile away. I mean, just felt like it was so much further than anything we ranged it. It was 281, and I'm like, man, you know, you hear these guys on TV or you know, whatever, shooting at 500 yards, and I'm just like, man, I can't even wrap my head around that, you know?
Yeah, that is a long shot, and especially on an antelope. Like, 280 on an antelope, that's getting to be long, too. Like, I'm definitely, I'd scale with what I'm shooting at. Like, 350 on a deer, I'm like, ooh, this is getting to be a long ways. 300 yards on an antelope, like that's a long shot. 400 or 500 yards on an elk, like I don't love shooting long range. I shot an antelope at 100 yards with my 300 Win Mag, and I was just like, there's a herd of does. I had a doe tag, and I'm like, one of you is dead. You don't know it yet, but one of you is absolutely dead. And it was kind of like, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, that one gives me the best shot. Boom. And just, it was over. Like, there was so much confidence and conviction when I pulled that trigger that it's like, that's what I want. Imagine shooting a bull elk at 60 yards with a 300 Win Mag. Like, how good that feels when the trigger goes off, and you're like, that elk is dead.
I'll take sub 100 any day over getting over that 100-yard mark. I mean, yeah, it's 281. That antelope just seemed out there, you know. But I'm shooting a 30-06, a little overkill for an antelope, but it's what I got, you know. But it was fun. It was fun. It was out there a ways, but I was able to get the job done anyway.
So that's a good point. So you shot a 30-06 with an antelope, 300 yards. What was the bullet performance like on that antelope? Did you have, obviously you got a pass through, but did you have a big blow out on the backside? Did you hit any major bones? Like, how did that go for you?
Yeah, I actually, you know, the wind was kind of blowing that day and I didn't really take an account for it. That, you know, everything happened so fast. I actually shot over him at probably 200 and He ran another 80 yards out there or so, and you know, I took another shot, and I actually spined him, which isn't, you know, an ideal shot or anything. And I shot my gun, and it was on. So I don't know, just in the excitement of things, if I pulled a little bit, you know, if the wind helped a little bit, because the wind was blowing 30 miles an hour that day. You know, I don't know what the deal was. But, yeah, it left a pretty good hole in him, you know, at that range.
Yeah, and especially with hitting that. Having the right tool for the job can make all the difference in the world, and that applies for Western hunts too, especially if you're coming from the Midwest like myself, because if you don't have it, there's no going home to get it. And that's why many of us Western hunters are also gear junkies, and the same is true for the folks over at Go Hunt. They have built the Go Hunt gear shop to be jam-packed full of the best, highest quality gear needed for your Western hunt. They try out everything that gets into the shop, and if they don't like it or they don't use it, it doesn't make the cut. So if you need something for your next trip, Go Hunt has something for you in the gear shop. They've got everything from optics, gear, camping accessories, apparel, footwear. They've got packs, and they've got some of the best brands in the industry. So if you're in the market for some new gear, consider checking out the Go Hunt gear shop. They're an avid supporter of the outdoors. They are supporters of this podcast, and most importantly, they're supporters of you. They want to help you be more successful in the West, so there's no better place to shop for gear, information, and knowledge than Go Hunt. And if you use the code WESTERN when you check out, you're going to get 10% off most of the regular priced items in the shop. So head over to GoHunt.com, get the gear you need, use the code WESTERN, and get the right tool for the job this fall. Spine, that probably puts a little bit more hole in it. Because, you know, I'm kind of asking because I've always heard, you know, oh, way too much for antelope. You're going to waste so much meat. Well, I was kind of in the same boat as you. I drew an antelope doe tag when I lived in North Dakota, and all I had at the time was that 300 Win Mag on a Expo long range max. And so I'm like, this is what I'm going to use it. At that time, I didn't own a single other rifle. I didn't even have a Rimfire 22. Yep. I mean, it's like, it's this or my slug gun. At this point.
Yep.
And maybe the slug gun would have been better. I don't think so. I think it would have left a bigger hole at 100 yards. But I shot that doe, double lung, right, tucked it right behind the shoulder. I didn't hit any major bones. And the entry and exit holes were almost the same size. I mean, virtually non-existent exit hole. I had to cut maybe a baseball size chunk of meat out of the kind of the, I don't know what the muscle would be, but every deer hunter knows it's like that in the front quarter. There's that little muscle that kind of goes from the forearm to the blade. That's it. Like the archery, like that's where you want your arrow to be. I had to cut a little bit of that out, which that meat doesn't, I've always struggled with that anyway.
You're a ton of meat off a front quarter of an antelope anyway. Yeah. 2 years ago, I actually shot my antelope at about 80 yards with that 30-06, and, you know, I don't remember there being a hole at all as far as, you know, a big hole in the backside. It was basically entry exit and wasn't much, you know, meat loss as far as that goes. Like I said, 80 yards, the bullet was moving pretty quick. So,
yeah. And a 30 at six, I'm not a, there's going to be people in the comments that could correct me on all my ballistics, but I believe like the 300 Win Mag is like a Magnum version of a 30 at six. So just a little bit more juice. You know, people go back and forth. I'm like, shoot the rifle that feels best. Shoot the rifle you can put the bullet in the best. If that's a 301 meg on an antelope, put it in a double lung. You know, you're probably not going to expand. You know, if your limit's 300 yards on an antelope because they're such small targets, I feel like at 300 yards, those 30 cal magnums are still flying, that they're not going to really expand and damage meat unless you hit them in the front shoulder. But I bet if you hit the antelope in the front shoulder with a 223, you're wrecking that quarter anyway. So, you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like everyone is so adamant that you can't hunt antelope with a 30 caliber, despite, like, both ends of the conversation are worse. Like, for one, if you don't hit a bone, the 30 calibers are going so fast, they're not going to expand and cause any damage. And if you do hit a bone with anything, it's going to cause damage. So it's like, lose-lose. Like, what do you want me to do here?
Exactly. We, my nephew went with us last year, antelope hunting out in Wyoming, and we just bought him. I bought him a 308 for his graduation present, and he used that, and I was impressed with that gun too. So,
yeah, well, the 308, I mean, that's one of those like Hall of Fame calibers.
Yep.
I'd say like the 30-06 and the 30-08 are, or the 308 are all, those are Hall of Fame calibers. Like, more things have died from those two calibers than ever will from a Creedmoor.
Yep. I you know, I did my research. I wanted to get him a gun that, you know, he could hunt elk with, hunt antelope with, hunt whitetails with, whatever the case may be. I wanted to get him that one gun, so that way he didn't have to get a couple different guns for a couple of different things. And that 308 just kept coming up, and I thought, you know, the bullets aren't, you know, they're not near as big as a 30-06. And, you know, I thought, you know, that's the caliber I went with, and man, it's a smooth shooting gun. So, you know, I think he liked it. So,
yeah, I think the 308's a caliber that can do everything the 30-06 or the 300 Win can do with less kick and maybe not moose at a mile. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But for a young whippersnapper that's got his first rifle, like, you're not going to want to give him a 4-pound, you know, 338 Lapua. No. Like, he can't carry a heavy rifle to quiet down a, you know, a super magnum, because he just gets tired. No one wants that, and you can't, you know, put those big calibers in a light rifle and expect them to play nice.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So. Nah, he was thrilled. That was his first rifle, so, I mean, it wouldn't have mattered what it was. He was going to be happy.
Yeah, I remember my first, I think I won a raffle, and I won a gun, and my dad, I remember being very disappointed in my dad, because he walked up, and, you know, I'm like, I won this gun, Dad. It's on the youth raffle. And he's like, yeah, we're going to trade it in on something because you're not going to like that gun. And I'm like, what do you mean? I want that gun. It's my gun. I want it. And he's like, no, it's not. Trust me, you don't want that. We'll get you something else. And it took forever. This was way back. I was 5 years old, so this wasn't any kind of gun crisis or anything. It just took a while. And he got me a 10/22 Ruger, and I did like it a lot more. The gun I won was like some combo gun where you could replace a barrel and make it into a 22 or a 12 gauge. And so I just remember being so disappointed that I couldn't bring it home. But little did I know, you never get to bring them home from the banquet. You always have to go in and do your FFL.
Yep.
So
nowadays, I think they speed that up a little bit. They got guys that, yeah, at least the Pheasants Forever banquet I was just at, they got guys that speed that up. If you win a gun, I think you can go and
If they get the authorized FFL to show up to the banquet and do the paperwork there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which, that's nice. It makes a lot better than having to wait for your gun till a later date.
I'll tell you what, winning a bow is an efficient process. The little kid runs it over to your table, and they don't even ask you another question. You just walk out the front door with a bow. Like, you know what I mean? Obviously, it's not a firearm, but there was no paperwork. There was nothing. It was like, you know, 372, and I raised my hand, and the guy just points and goes, over there, and then he draws another one. Like, they didn't have any, like, confirmation that he gave it to the right person or anything. Kid didn't even check my ticket. He just handed us a bow and ran back. So, No, I like the rifle conversation. I really do. There's so many unique things you can do with it, and everyone gets to pick their own story, which I think is fun. You know, I went with a 13-pound hunting rifle. That's what I carry out west. It's a big gun. It's a long barrel, giant muzzle brake, giant scope. I just love it. I can dial my range. I can measure my windage, all the fun things.
Yep.
My wife went the other direction. She's like, I want a light gun. I want it to be simple to use. She did join my side, the dark side, with a first focal plane scope. So she can measure and dial and everything, no matter what magnification she's at. But she wanted something that didn't kick. She wanted a one size fits all. That's, you know, I probably would have went 28 Nosler 270 Win if we could have picked any caliber, but we didn't have those options. So she's doing that. I really want to pick another gun for myself. I'd really like to find like a coyote, antelope, maybe whitetail size. You know what I mean? Like, it'd be kind of the same. I don't know. Maybe that's just my MO, but like, it'd be the same as shooting an antelope with a 300 Win Mag of, you know, coyote hunting with a whatever it turns out to be. And I'd love it to be in like an AR platform.
Yo.
I just don't know what like caliber that is. What was that?
Would that be like in the 243 range, maybe?
Probably, if they could do that in a. I was thinking, I've heard some people say, Blake Garrett was on the podcast, big coyote hunter. And he said, I've been really loving the 6mm Creedmoor, but he's doing it in an AR-10, which isn't the end of the world. Mm-hmm. I just was hoping for a 15 because it's lighter and cheaper.
Yeah.
But he was having good luck with that 6mm because it doesn't blow around as much in the wind with that 90-grain bullet as like a 223 would, for example. And then, you know, here in Minnesota, we've got legislation that seems like it's always on the chopping block of opening up rifle season because the northern half of the state gets rifle season. And all of our family farms are one unit south of the border.
Oh. Yeah. It won't be long. I think Iowa's heading that direction too. You know, we used to be just, you know, your slug guns, your Orange Army, and now we're slowly moving into the straight-walled rifles, and I just think we're moving in that direction too. It won't be long, I don't think. We'll be using rifles also down here.
Well, what's interesting is Minnesota and Iowa have, or southern Minnesota and Iowa have almost the same setup. The dates are different, but it's the firearm season is a shotgun season. But in Iowa, the 350 Legend is legal.
Yep.
In Minnesota, the 350 Legend is not legal.
Really?
No, it's not legal. You guys just
straight slugs or
it I think the law it's written to be like a shot shell cartridge.
Okay.
Which is the key. And so it needs like the internal wad, apparently. So just a straight, okay. I think Iowa's law says straight walled cartridge, and they meant shotgun shells. And the 350 Legend is just a straight walled cartridge now.
Yep.
Ours is like a shot shell cartridge. So then they're like, nah, it has to be straight walls and have a wad.
Okay. I shoot a 450 Bushmaster. I think I wish I would have went with the 350 Legend. Yeah, I hunt with a guy that has one. It's kind of a.
This episode is brought to you by Steelhead Outdoors. From the moment I first saw a Steelhead Outdoor safe, I knew I was going to order one. The ability to customize the color, the configuration, and most importantly, the ability to move and assemble my safe panel by panel makes Steelhead Outdoors the clear winner when it comes to gun safes. And if you haven't ordered a Steelhead Outdoor gun safe yet, you can still benefit from their innovation and creativity because the guys over at Steelhead have designed some awesome accessories. Their case keeper allows you to hang all of your hunting caps and gun cases off the side of your safe, and it keeps your hunting room looking clean and organized. Or my favorite is the bow keeper that lets me hang my bow off the side of my safe so me and my wife can walk into our safe room, hang up our bows after shooting in the backyard, and not have to worry about the hassle of putting our bows back in the case every time. Both the bow keeper and case keeper are magnetic and work with any safe, which means you can use them now with your current safe, and when the time comes to order your Steelhead Outdoors gun safe, you'll already have all the accessories you need. Head over to steelheadoutdoors.com to order your bow keeper and case keeper today.
Smoother shooting gun, I feel like, and not near as loud. I don't think it kicks as much, but I have no complaints with the 450 Bushmaster either. So,
well, I wonder what the 450. What's the range on your 450 Bushmaster?
Right now I got it dialed to about 150. I think it can go out to, you know, two. I'm not sure. You know, I have, every time they say a rifle can shoot out to here, I always dial it back because I just don't feel comfortable a lot of those times hitting that, you know, that long range on it. Like you said earlier, you know, 500 seems like a long way as well. 200 with a 450 Bushmaster seems like a long way as, you know, so I like to, you know, 100, 150 is about as far as I like to shoot with those things.
Well, I'll tell you what, 200 yards with a 4.5 power scope on my shotgun look like a long ways because I stared at a buck this year for 2 hours. 200 yards.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure I found a lot of sheds, so I can kind of score them based off other sheds I found. And I've had a lot of people like, hey, what do you think this buck scores? And nobody was in the 140s. Everybody was in the 150s and 160s, and the people that I respected the most typically were closer to 160, 165. And that's where I would have put. I mean, he had it all. He was just your average stud. Like, he wasn't a 200-inch deer or anything. He wasn't Gross Boone. He had height, mass, a couple kickers, a big hoop. I mean, he just looked beautiful. And I looked at that buck for 2 hours. And a 4.5 power scope's not very much at 200 yards. And I have had my shotgun touching slugs before in two round groups at 200 yards.
Like
our shotguns, the ones that we use, I don't know if we got lucky off the manufacturing line or just the setups we intentionally build, are incredibly accurate. You know, I know I can put that slug in the vitals at 200 yards. The problem is I don't know what I just switched slugs and I didn't know what the drop was. And I do know that the energy starts to fade fast after like 100.
Yep.
And so I was like, I just can't do it.
When I was shooting slugs, 100 was about the range that I wanted to, about the max range I wanted to be at, because it just seemed like after that, you know, my group started getting bigger. And like you said, the slugs lose energy so fast that about 100 yards is about as far as I wanted to shoot. So, and a lot of times where I hunt, you know, we're hunting timber and stuff. You're not seeing much more than 100 anyway. You know, we're not sitting on field edges and stuff. A lot of my shotgun group is still old school. Deer drives and stuff is still strong in Iowa. You know, you got the younger generation that are kind of against it. And you got the older generation that are all for it, and they're kind of just butting heads. Well, that's my shotgun group. Younger generation just wants to sit. Older generation wants to push deer around. So we're kind of in that battle zone right now. So we're making a lot of deer drives and stuff, and you know, we're not shooting much more than 100 anyway with them slugs.
Isn't that funny that the older generation's like, no, let's go, let's get at it, the deer there, we're gonna push them out, we're gonna go get them, and the younger guy's like, let's just sit and wait.
I know, and it never fails too. After that first day, the next morning, the guys, you know, we'll all meet up before we go, and they can barely walk. They're hobbling around. Their backs are hurt. Their knees are shot. And they just are always just like, we got to push deer around. And we're like, no, if we just sit, let everybody around us push deer into us, we'll just sit and just let the deer what the deer do. And they just can't do it because they've been brought up so many years doing the same thing, and they just think that's the way it's got to be. And, you know, I don't blame them, but it's just the younger mentality is, you know, let the deer be the deer and you know, sit in travel corridors, whatever the case may be, and get them that way. But, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's like I want to play chess with this deer, and some people are like, F chess, we're bowling these suckers down. We're going for strikes.
Yep.
And so,
oh, man.
We've got some of the same. We used to, our party used to be like a sit till 9 and then walk.
Yep.
And so I've seen it before. I agree. I like to kill my deer in July and August. It just doesn't happen until November.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like all the food plot and the work and setting stuff up. And I'm really getting into some habitat management ideas, taking it maybe even one step farther than a lot of people like to do. I'm trying to find a plan for like 100 fruit trees to put in the ground here at this farm. I'm thinking about putting some real tight spaced visual barriers in our food plots. So instead of like a 1 acre food plot, I'm thinking of making like 3 or 4 micro plots in that bigger area.
Yep.
Like completely walled. I'm playing with different things because it's the first chance I've had to, like, I own a tractor now that's a great food plot tractor on the farm that I live, and I'm like, my wife definitely is on board too, and she wants to be a part of all these decisions. But like, we can do whatever we want now for the first time. We don't have family members to get on board, and everyone gets to vote on what food plots we plant where. It's like, it's just me and Abby. We get to pick what we want. And for most part, she's on board with what I want. In that regard, she's like, whatever you think's best.
I like that theory with breaking up that, you know, making a few micro plots. Are you having barriers in between?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I've heard them bucks, if you just have one big food plot, they'll come out, glance, whatever's there, they'll take off, whatever the case may be. With the micro plots, they tend to spend more time out there, it seems like, from what I've heard and what I've read. And, they check each micro plot, and it keeps them in that area longer, and they're having to check each micro plot to see where the does are at. And yeah, I've heard that too, and seems like a great idea.
Yeah, so this farm, it's kind of a blank slate in terms of habitat and food plots, because there wasn't a lot of, it's like 35 acres of real thick brush, and so I'm getting in there and brush hogging and open it up, but I'm picking the shapes I want. And the two that I'm most excited about are both like 90 degree L's or V's, depending on which direction it points. But they're like 30 yards by 100 yards down both sides, stands in the base of the V. That way I can hunt like 270 degrees of wind.
Yep.
Almost. I mean, it not perfect, but I'm also putting big huts in there with windows to control my scent. But I'm thinking of making like the first area would be bow range, right? So 30 yards out and 30 yards down both V. I'm going to try to plant something tall, like Miscanthus, to block that area off, right? Because that's the real trigger point. Like if I put it any wider, well, if that deer's standing at 50, I can't really shoot him with my bow anywhere. I'm not a 50-yard whitetail guy or 40. So if it's at 30, it's like if they come into that center one, they're fair game. Plus, that's close enough with my platform that I got. I just working on a project with a company here I'm really excited about. I can probably get over that first layer and with the shotgun still cover the other two areas, but now there's at least three different areas of that buck, and they're all going to be meaningful size. They're all going to be like 4/10, 5/10 of an acre. So they're not like micro. I mean, that's still a pretty good size food plot, but I'm going to play with that to start with and see if it needs to be broken up any more than that. But I'm thinking, put a little alleyway that they walk out, basically they can wrap that V. The shape I did for a V was intentional to the, like, originally it's just like they'll walk the V, they'll wrap around to see the other side, and they'll pass broadside within 30. I'm just kind of taking that one step up of blocking them off, so they can't just come out to the side and check the middle. They have to walk all the way to the middle, and they have to walk all the way to the other side. So maybe put that gap at 20 yards, put the scrape tree down at 20 yards in the center plot. We're playing, right? Like, this isn't science. This is all newer stuff, and some people have been doing it for 5-10 years, but no one's been doing that for 50 years, so we don't really know how it's going to work out.
There's so many things you can do with food plots. I grew up in the TV era like you, watching the Drurys and the Lakoskis and stuff, and man, Mark Drury, I think he's one of the best at it when it comes to food plot architecture and some of his ideas, and man, he gets some bucks to come in there. And yeah, there's lots of different things guys can do to utilize their area a lot better than just making one big food plot. There's ways to make it a lot better than it is.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I love Drury's. I think I'm on the same page. It's like, they're one of the best. Lakowski's one of the best. There's a couple people that maybe no one knows about, but I mean, it's hard to be better than them, for example.
Yep.
And I would just love to, like, I've never been able to plant everything that I want. And it's because our family farms are enrolled in a lot of programs that, are cash flow positive now, especially that the farms are paid off.
Yep.
And so we got a lot of rules on what we can and can't plant there. And then this new farm that we got, we have total control. There's not a single program yet. We're trying to get some cost share and some stuff, but it's lower ground. So it's not like you can just go nuts, right?
Yep.
I would love to have that place where you could put in like a like you've got a 30-acre field to play with, and now you can really do anything. Obviously, not probably going to plant it all in food plot, but I mean, may, imagine taking that same strategy, putting it on a scale of like 10x, and now we have 15 one-acre plots all within muzzleloader range for late season.
Yeah,
you know, sectioned off with tall grass or corn or whatever it is. I mean,
and you're going to figure out. Dude, you're gonna figure out what the deer want to eat at certain times of the year, and be able to adjust accordingly too. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So that would be like the dream. I've always thought it would be amazing to be able to buy like a 640 of black dirt and just start from the ground up.
Yep.
I don't know if it's better to start with like a 640 of black dirt or a 640 of solid trees and cut them down.
Either.
One of them's a lot more work, but the part that takes forever shows up right away, and the other one's like a lot easier, but it takes a lot longer.
I can tell you, a 640 of black dirt's going to cost you a lot more.
Yeah, that's true. You know,
especially in my neck of the woods, 640 of black dirt. It's
you'd have to win the Powerball twice to buy a 640 of black dirt in your neck of the woods.
Oh, we just had just northwest of me in Sioux County, a farm just sold for $29,000 an acre.
How big of a farm?
I think it was just an 80.
Because technically, but I paid like $29,000 an acre for my first lot I built a house on.
Yeah, you for one lot, yeah.
But yeah, it's not, I don't think you could call a seventh of an acre a farm.
No, no, this is $29,000 for farmland acres, and it was 80 of them. Yeah, it's crazy what the price is doing. And
I don't understand how that works, like,
you can't pencil it out. I mean, what it amounts to is somebody that probably has a lot of acres he owns already, and he's able to, you know, take the cash flow from those acres and just buy a piece of ground with it.
It must be hopefully it's a farmer that's very financially savvy, and he's like, I have everything paid off, and since everything's paid off, I get hit with huge taxes, so it's like I either lose this money either way. At least this, I get some more land, because I can't get any. Like, this is the only way I can get more land. I can't rent anymore. No matter how much money I have, I can't just rent more, because it's all like, you know what I mean? Like, it's all taken. Yeah. I fear it's probably a billionaire from like California or New York or China.
It's a lot of it is a lot of these, the bigger farmers around here, you know, they have a lot of their ground paid off, and you know, they're farming, you know, 3,000-4,000. 5,000 acres, and they're able to, if you got your land paid off, and you know, you're not making that rent payment every month, it's, you can buy a piece of the ground. Now, $29,000 an acre, that's a hefty chunk, but
yeah, a $3 million 80. Oof.
Yep.
Yikes. I don't know why you didn't buy it. I mean, what's that? How many shoulder mounts is that to buy a $3 million 80?
And a lifetime's worth, not even more than a lifetime's worth.
Yeah,
me and my brother and I are actually looking into buying some timber ground, and we've just kind of been shopping here and there. And you know, even timber ground from where it was 5-10 years ago, that's crazy. You know, when there's no income on it, it's just straight timber ground. You're like, wow. You know, but we'll have a chunk here shortly, I'm hoping, and be able to do whatever we want to do on it. But that's where we're at right now, is just kind of shopping, window shopping right now.
I feel for you in your neck of the woods, man, because it's not, I mean, timber ground in your neck of the woods, you're still probably looking at close to 5 figures an acre, which sucks.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, you know, Iowa's got that reputation with the big deer and everything, and it shows. I mean, it's timber ground, it's guys coming in from the cities and you know, buying her up, and you got to contend with that. And I get it. You know, I don't blame them. I don't blame anybody for wanting to own a piece of timber ground to hunt on and everything, but yeah, it's getting tougher nowadays.
So I don't think there's any replacement for land ownership. I think you should buy all the land you can. I'm going to try to buy all the land I can. But one thing I always think about, this was unique because our house came on it and everything is a farmstead. But like the next piece, I always think about like, okay, if I were to go buy a 40, virtually wherever the 40 is, you could either buy those 40 acres or you could go on a hunt for 40 years. Now, you could go on a guided elk hunt for 40 years. I could maybe go on a Canadian whitetail hunt for 40 years. But it's almost like, man, if the goal is just to shoot stuff, right? If that was the only goal, which it's not, it's an investment, it's recreation, yep. it's all kinds of hobby and everything tied into one. But if your only goal was like, I want to shoot more bucks, you'd shoot way more bucks for way less time in way less energy just going to Canada. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, man, you brought that up and I can think in my head now, I'm like, man, what would I do? You know, I'm thinking if it's just a four.
If you're looking forward to another fall of hunting big bucks, but you're tired of freezing your tail off or getting busted by does, head over to maverickhunting.com and check out their Maverick and Booner blinds. Both series are incredibly easy to set up and get out in the woods. I set up two of the 6-panel blinds in the same week. And whether your favorite spot is on a field edge or way back in the sanctuary, you can have a hard-sided blind in your favorite spot this season. Keep the elements out and your scent in with a Maverick hunting blind. The best part is Maverick blinds ship out of their factory in just 1 or 2 days, which means you still have plenty of time to get a comfortable blind set up before the cold weather arrives and those big bucks are cruising through your spots. Go to maverickhunting.com and use the code WESTERNROOKIE, that's one word, to save 10%. That's right, 10% on your Maverick hunting blinds.
40, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have family that lets me hunt some private grounds. You know, I've got private ground to hunt. I'm like, man, 40 elk hunts would be pretty sweet to go on every year.
Especially guided elk hunts. I mean, you'd have to you would have to invest the 40th year because by that time it's going to be a lot more. But yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's like you got to, when you think about that, I feel like it just puts a layer of like caution over the decision. Like,
yep,
is this 100%. Really worth that? Like, is this, and you're going to know right away, right?
Yep.
You're going to be like, yes, yep, this property, hands down, every time. Or if it's not, you're going to be like, you know what? That's a good point. This one's not the right one yet. We got to keep looking.
Yep. Yeah, it's a definitely nowadays, it's a big decision. It's not just a, you know, sign on the dotted line fast. It's, I mean, you really got to think it over, you know. What are you going to do in the future? You got to back some stuff off, you know, maybe not go on so many hunts, you know, you got a piece of ground to pay for now. And yeah, it's a huge decision, but, you know, it's one that I'm ready to definitely look into, you know, cause like I said, the way hunting ground is now, especially around where I hunt, you either have to know somebody or you have to lease, because it's the days on knocking on doors are getting tougher and tougher to do. That's the main reason, you know, I got 3 nephews and, you know, what's going to look like for them in 20 years, you know, when they're my age or whatever, you know, so it's something to think about anyway.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think a lot of people like to think about like, it's not going in the right direction, but life happens. Life is expensive. Like every hobby adds up. Like, hunting might be worse than others and maybe better than others. I think it's just important. Like, if you got big dreams, like you got to make some really good decisions when you're too young to be making good decisions.
I wish older me could go back and tell younger me to make a few different decisions, just like everybody else. But but I'm also one of those too. Like, if I didn't have any private ground to hunt, if I didn't have this or that, I'd still be grinding. I'd find some public ground. I'd still be doing what I'm doing. You know, I know some guys that quit hunting altogether because they couldn't find private this or that. And that's just not me. You know, I'm going to grind no matter what. So it's just, I'm fortunate enough to have private ground, but either way I'm out there. So
that's one of my favorite things about hunting the West is that there's a ton of public land that everyone listening to this podcast, you own a slice of that pie just for being an American. And unless you're not an American listening to this podcast, but it's out there. And a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times, there's really good hunting on the public. There's obviously great hunting on the private too. But, you know, when you go to private, like in your neck of the woods, it's phenomenal. You go to public in your neck of the woods, there's people killing deer on it, but it is a whole different experience. When you go out west, you're having a very good experience a lot of times on public land in a lot of units. Like, there's a lot of opportunity, like antelope hunting. There's all kinds of antelope out there on public. I mean, that's one of the things I like about the West is like, you can just go do it.
Yep. We, 4 or 5 years ago, might even been longer, we went on a spot in stalking in Lopun with bows, out in South Dakota, Western South Dakota. And the whole time we were out there, I think we saw one guy. Like, we had the place to ourselves on public ground. It was awesome. And we were on antelope every day.
Well, that's probably because you're doing one of the hardest hunts.
Oh, it was. Yeah. I chose, you know, the first Western hunt I went on was elk hunting in Wyoming, South Dakota. And, man, that was an experience all in itself. I was not ready for that. And then the next hunt I chose was the spot and stalk for antelope with a bow. And I was like, man, I got to keep dialing it back. I got to move backwards to start moving forwards. And then, you know, we went on our rifle antelope hunt out in Wyoming the last couple of years. And then I'm like, all right, got my feet under me now in the West. Now we can start moving forward to the other games as far as that goes. And yeah, it's been, Western hunting's been an adventure for me between turkeys, antelope, and elk. And yeah, but it's been fun. It's the areas you see are crazy.
Yeah, they are. I have a question for you. Since you're a taxidermist and an antelope hunter, did you do any taxidermy with the antelope that you guys were shooting? Did you do any shoulder mounts or?
Yep.
Okay. How did you handle the fur? Because antelope are notorious for slippage. And so if a non-taxidermist wants to shoot an antelope, or, you know, they shoot an antelope, they want to get a trophy mount or a shoulder mount, I should say.
Yep.
What do they need to be aware of? Like, what do they need to do? I, for one, always hunt antelope with a cooler full of ice. Like, that's a rule. Yep. I have. I don't go out unless the cooler's got ice in it. But that's mostly for the meat.
We are fortunate enough. I hunt a private ranch. It's not guided or anything, but we hunt a private ranch. And he has freezers right there. You know, he has a cleaning shed and freezers right there. My suggestion, if you can, when we shot an antelope, we took it right back to the skinning shed. We caped it out. And the first thing we did was cape it out and get that cape cooling off in a freezer and getting it cooled off and getting it froze, because the longer you let it sit, it just seems like and that's not even foolproof either. Antelope hair, like you said, is the worst. I mean, it just pulls out in bunches.
Like, you cannot drag an antelope you want a shoulder mount.
No. Yeah, you cannot. I would not even try to drag it 5 feet, because you'll have, the way that hair pulls out is just, it's crazy. My first experience with it was wild. Even when you're cleaning it and you're pulling that fur, the hide off of it, wow, just the bunches of hair that comes out and you're not even really pulling that hard. It's a new experience. And luckily, before we went out there, I, you know, got on trusty Google and kind of Googled how you should handle antelope anyway. And yeah, basically it said, take care of it right away, get it on ice right away, get it in the freezer right away, whatever you got there, get it taken care of as fast as possible. And that was the biggest thing. And even after the tanning process, you get it home, you flesh it quick and get it tanned. Even after the tanning process, the hair tends to slip in spots. So there's a lot of, you got to be delicate with those things. It's crazy. I don't know how guys do. I'm sure there's taxidermists that probably do, you know, 50 a year or more. I don't know how they do it. It's tough to work with. It's kind of, you kind of sweat it out in the whole process, because you don't want the hair to slip in too many spots. And then you're having to, you know, cut those spots out and sew them up. It's tough. It's tough.
Yeah, I think, you know, typically we've always had a family taxidermist for whitetails back home by the farm.
Yep.
Friend of a family. Does phenomenal work. He did an elk, too, for me, and an elk for my brother. And just amazing work. Like, I think he could be a really competitive taxidermist if he ever did anything. He doesn't even have an Instagram page. Like, he's like, I do not want anymore. You know what I mean? Yep. The whole time, there must be deer in the backyard because my dog just barked. And so, but with antelope, I feel like, you know, so we've always brought stuff home. And it's getting to be a pain in the butt with CWD laws. You got to start caping things out yourself and boiling skulls. And we've always brought stuff home to bring to our family taxidermist. But with antelope, if I wanted a shoulder mount, that's probably one where I would strongly consider researching taxidermists ahead of time in that area that I have confidence in, which is tough, right? Because you never know these people. But I think visibility is a good starter. Like, if they're very visible on social media, posting stuff, websites, I just feel like that's probably a little bit of a confidence boost, because if they're that visible and they were a bad apple, people would be commenting like, hey, I brought this to this guy, he stole it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But I think that's one species where I'd probably leave in the state to get done by someone that does a lot of them.
That's a great piece of advice. Yeah, if you've got the chance and you're out hunting and, you know, research taxidermists maybe in that area, or, you know, if you're whatever part of Wyoming you're in, maybe on the way home, whatever the case may be, yeah, leave it in the state and just have somebody do it there. It's going to save you a lot of trouble, a lot of worry. Like I said, I'm able to do my own, you know, so I do a lot of the prep work there, you know, with, you know, caping it out and doing all that stuff and getting it home, you know, in the correct manner and then taking care of it here. But man, it's still a tough process of that hair. It's something else. It's crazy to work with, but it's fun. They're cool animals for sure.
You can't believe that when they fight, they don't just like rip all their hair off. Because they antelope fights are pretty intense.
Yeah. It was almost just an unreal experience when we first walked up to on them, and we drug one to get in position to take a picture, and we looked behind like 4 foot, and it was just nothing but hair. And we thought, you know, we didn't really know for sure. I mean, we knew going out there that they, you know, there was something, their hair was a little off, but man, it was a crazy experience seeing that for the first time. You know, whitetails, you know, I've drug them a half mile out of the trees, and if, you know, there's a little bit of anything, they're fine. But man, yeah, antelope's just a different experience.
Oh yeah, it's nothing to tie a whitetail to the back of the four-wheeler. People have done that forever, tie it to the back of the four-wheeler, yep. Drag it back to the farm. Like, that's, yeah, whitetails are, that's different for sure. Yeah, that's one thing I shot when I shot that doe. I noticed, like, just being careful, like, I knew antelope first slipped, and I was still shocked at how much it slipped. And that's what I was worried about. Yeah. Like, when you do, like, to do, anytime that I've shot something that I wanted shoulder mounted, especially when it's in bad position, like elk are the worst, right? Because they always die in some jungle. And so, yeah, I always go up and I do a 7 cut, typically, either a 7 cut or a Y cut on the back. But I follow the spine up, and then I, you know, I usually go about the belly button. So I usually save about enough hide to shoulder mount 2 elk. But even just that part, I think, you got to be really careful. Like, you can't pull on the hide like you normally would to, like, cut it loose. Like, you almost got to just, like, not put any force into the hide and just use your knife over and over again.
Well, I have a scalpel blade that I use for taxidermy. I mean, I actually take that out with us.
Yeah.
I take my little taxidermy kit out with us so I can take care of everything and be delicate with it, because just the hair on it was just – it's just crazy. You barely touch it, it comes out, it slips, comes out in handfuls. So yeah, I take that scalpel blade out with us, and I'm really, really careful with it. And we've had pretty good luck with that.
I have a shoulder mounting problem because it's expensive. I might have to do what you did and start doing my own stuff. I just got an elk back, and it's phenomenal, but it's just like, it gets more and more every year. And I understand it. Like, I'm a capitalist. I like small business. I'm all for it until I get the bill for my shoulder mount. And then I'm like, oh, God, this sucks. But
yeah. I tell you, you know, people are complaining that taxiderm prices are going up, but, you know, I don't blame taxiderms anywhere, because the forms and just the products, the ear liners and the eyes and whatever you use, that's all going up. Everything's going up in price. So the taxiderms have to then up their prices in order to make everything, you know, come together. And it's a lot of time, a lot of work. So,
well,
yeah, I got into it basically because I was poor at the time, fresh out of college. And my wife said, if you want head mounts all over the wall, then you're going to have to figure out how to do it yourself. And that's exactly what I did. And, you know, now that I can afford it, I'm still doing it. And, you know, but there are times I get burnt out pretty quick. So,
yeah. So, but it sounds like you're kind of finding that fine line between, like, not quite a hobby, but you do not want this to be your full-time job.
No, like I said, I have a full-time job. You know, I coach high school baseball during the summer, and I wanted about 3 or 4 months of the year during the winter, those winter months when you're not really outside much anyway, you know, before the sheds start dropping, before turkey season starts, I just wanted those months. I said, all right, I want enough to get me through those months. And then that's it. And I've got it down pretty good about how many heads I can take, and then I'm done by March.
Yeah. So here's a question for you. If you were to do 50 whitetail shoulder mounts a year, would that be like a full-time job? Would that be, I mean, it doesn't really work this way, but you kind of got to like average it across the year. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I mean, if I stay, like I said, a lot of what I do is on the weekends. You know, I go to my full-time job all week long. I'll do some prep work at nights, you know, work with the hide, tan the hide, whatever, do that at nights. But on the weekends is when I do my actually putting, you know, the hide on the form and doing all that stuff. And, you know, 50 is probably not a full-time job at all. I would say you have to get up around 100 or more. And that's just in the whitetail department. A lot of taxidermists will do, in my area, I'll do 100 or more whitetails. And then on top of that, they're doing turkeys. You know, they're doing whatever elk they get, you know, whatever mule deer they get.
Yeah.
You know, so they're also a year or two before you get it back because they're that backed up on everything because, you know, their workload. And I don't know how they don't get burnt out. Kudos to them for not. But, yeah, it's a workload.
Right. So let's just, for example, say you could do 100 in a year and get them all back in a year, right? Full-time job. Mm-hmm. Well, our taxidermist back home, and I don't want to ask you because it doesn't matter what you charge, but this guy, since he doesn't listen to this podcast, he doesn't have social media, and he doesn't want your business, he charges $800 for a shoulder, a whitetail mount right now, which I grew up, when I started growing up, it was $450. Now it's $800.
Yep.
Is what it is. Yep. But if you did 100 of them at $800, right, that's 80 grand gross.
Yep.
You got forms, you got supplies, you got tanning fees, you got business, self-employment taxes out of that, like all kinds of different fees. I'm like, I'm in a position where it's like that. I work less than that and make more than that now. Like I feel for you because it's like a full-time taxidermist and you're like, man, $800, that's ridiculous. You're making all this money. You got 100 of these things. It's like, yeah, you may be making 40 grand. Lucky. If you got a really good operating ship, you might squeak out 40 out of that 100 mounts.
He's not making a killing.
No. And he's working full-time all year long to make, I think a lot of taxidermists probably do better. You add in some things here and there. You do a habitat, a display, an elk, but still, it all adds, like it takes a long time to add up, and it's one of those things where there's no getting around the hours. Like, if you want to make more money, you got to do more hours. Where a lot of other jobs that you can like kind of, you know, work more efficiently.
Yeah, they're working 7 days a week. A lot of them taxidermists, and yeah, it's just not. Like I said, I got into it to make a little side cash, and it helps pay for my trips out west, and that's as much as I want to go with it. And it's just, it burns me out real quick. And like I said, kudos to the guys that do it full time.
Did you go to, so since you do it for other people, did you have to go to a taxidermy school and get certified?
I did not. So what I did, and I got on YouTube, and I bet I worked on my own stuff, and I would tell people to bring me stuff for free. I didn't charge anything in it. And I just practiced for probably 5, 6, 7 years. And then I got good enough that, you know, I decided to start charging then. But I practiced probably a good chunk of the time. It would have been quicker for me to go to a school probably. But I just didn't have, at the time, I didn't have the time. So I'd get home from work at nights and just practice. And, you know, I started practicing tanning. And then, you know, from there, you know, doing the full thing on forms and just started tweaking everything. And I would watch YouTube channels and this and that. And that's how I tweaked myself to do it.
Yeah. I'm at that point, especially if my wife starts killing big deer that she wants shoulder. She's not a huge shoulder mount fan, but she shoots more deer than me. So if she becomes a shoulder mount fan, we're going to have an issue really fast.
Yep.
And so I'm thinking, I'm strongly considering, because I'm one of those people, it's like, I can figure out a lot of things. Like, I just replaced our bathroom sink because it broke. I'm not a plumber. I've never even seen that. I didn't even know it was possible. We had our well go out on us, and I fixed that. You know, it took me a couple days to figure out what was going on, but now I know how to fix a well and replace a bathroom sink. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, these things aren't necessarily hard, but, you know, it's just one of those things you got to learn how to do it. And I've always, like, I do all my old maintenance. I figured out how to replace the front end bearings on my pickup. And so I'm like, I feel like I could figure it out. Now,
you could.
My question is it actually going to save me money to do one a year? And that's where I feel like there's a real honest question. Like, how many are you actually going to mount? Because I feel like the first one's probably not very much savings with all the things you'd probably have to buy and learn. And
Yeah, with the things you'd need, you're not – it's going to take you some before you're actually going to start saving yourself some money. Unless you can get on – I mean, they got taxidermy sites that you can buy used stuff off of. And, you know, you can do that and save yourself some money there. But – and really with a deer, like I still flesh all my deer hides and stuff. You know, a lot of people have them big – Dakota fleshers and big mechanical fleshers. I do everything by hand still, you know, with a hand flesher.
Well, so it takes buying a Dakota fletcher, what do those things cost? $9,000, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there's different sizes, but yeah, you're looking anywhere from two to, I mean, they get up there. So it's,
that definitely is not saving. That's what my wife's afraid of, is that I will become my own taxidermist to save money and then go buy $10,000 worth of equipment. Yep.
And that, you know, I started out doing a hand flesher and that's just kind of the way I've always done it. Cause I'm, you know, it doesn't bother me. I only do 15 or 20 I can hide in no time at night, you know, one night I can get it fleshed. But man, as the years go on, I'm thinking more and more about getting one of them fleshers. Cause man, they look handy.
Yeah. Well, you do enough of them, it probably would make sense for me doing one or two a year. I mean, that's where it's like, if we both shot nice bucks off our own farm, like, I would want to shoulder mount it. She can do whatever she wants. I'm never going to tell her she has to. I might tell her she has to shoulder mount certain deer. Like, babe, this is a 180-inch buck we've been chasing for 4 years, and you shot him. Like, I really think we should shoulder mount him instead of a Euro. I don't know. But it's ultimately her decision. But that would be like $1,600 bucks a year. Throw in a mule deer every now and then, or an elk every now and then. And it's like, we could easily be seeing $2,000-$3,000 a year in taxidermy bills. And that's where I'm thinking, you know, especially if I can batch two or three of them up.
Yep.
That's where it probably would make sense.
You know, 1 year I shot, I shot a 180, a 150, and a 140 some, or whatever the case may be. And just in that 1 year, I saved myself, you know, $1,000 or more by being able to do it myself. You know, so that helps.
The problem is, I don't want to. This is going to come up the next time I shoot a big buck, and that's not the one I want to practice on, right? So it's like, I got to start practicing on deer that, you know, I wouldn't normally shoulder mount. So now I'm paying more than I usually would.
Yeah, that's what I did too. My brother actually still has. He shot a little 8-point. And it was the first deer I ever mounted. And it's just an awful looking mount. Like I said, it was the first one I mounted. And you look at it, and where I'm at now, it's a big difference. But you know, he still has it. I told him one day, I said, you know, I'll rip that old hide off and I'll get the horns remounted for you. He's like, no. He goes, I like it. It's your first mount you ever did. He goes, yeah, it doesn't look very good. But he's like, I'm going to keep that around. So
I feel like my one thing that I could do, I'm an entrepreneur at Spirit, and we got to get you on the other podcast too, because that's more of an entrepreneur podcast.
Yep.
I would do it, and I'd sell them as decoys until I got good enough.
I'm thinking about doing that with turkeys.
Now we really got a topic, because I've been, the last three nights, I've been Googling how to tan a turkey hide, because I've never shot a turkey, but I want to shoot a Jake so I can make a full-body decoy and invest in my future turkey hunting.
Yep. Tanning bird hides isn't
it's easier, that difficult. Right?
Yeah, it's, there's really nothing to it. It's just a matter of
mounting them is the problem.
Skinning it and just getting, you know, just kind of, I have a bird flesher and just take what fat and stuff you can get off of it. And yeah, it's really not that difficult. And the only problem is bird skin is just, it's tough to work with. And it's, you have to be a lot more detail oriented when you're working with turkeys. And
yeah,
it, like I said, I mounted three of my own turkeys and they look all right, but it's just a lot of work. So I bailed out of mounting turkeys pretty quick.
Well, I'm really interested in the turkey decoy. So if I shoot a Jake this year, I'll be DMing you.
There you go.
Hey, we got to figure something out here, because I want a turkey decoy, a full body turkey.
Yep.
Because that's probably going to make up for my lack of turkey hunting skills, is just having the world's best decoy.
I can't believe you never turkey hunted. You live in the Midwest.
I turkey hunted. I've never killed a turkey. There's a difference.
Oh, there you go.
I did it a little bit in college, but I was driving like 2 hours, not scouting at all. You know, yep. By the time I'd get the trail camera pictures back, it's been 2 weeks and they aren't there anymore. Now, yep. We get turkeys in our backyard every now and then. And so my wife wants to do it right. I want to shoot one off the deck while I'm eating my breakfast one morning. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But I do want to get into it, and I want to go out west. I think down the road I'd love to do a western turkey shed hunt combo.
Yep.
Because it's a better excuse to get out there and find sheds.
Yeah, we go out. We don't get too far out west. We go out to western Nebraska every year. We've been doing that for 10 years. And then I've hunted the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota and shot a couple of Merriams off that in the past too. So it's always a blast. You can get out there, you know, you're been sitting in the house all winter long, and finally, you know, bow season in Nebraska opens up end of March. So you're kind of raring to get out and do something. And it's kind of just the start of turkey season and get you out and doing something anyway.
Yeah. I want to go where there's elk sheds. So that way I can find elk sheds. And my wife
goes, there you go. Turkeys.
I want to get into the elk shed hunting thing, and it's an investment in time and money for me, because I live in Minnesota, so I got to get out there. I got to try it. It's going to go pretty poorly for the first few years. I've met some really good friends through this podcast that have brought us out, and we've done good there, but I would love to like get to the point where I can learn it myself too, and not have to rely on other people to bring me to their spots, even though they're the world's nicest people by far. I mean, shout out to Steven for bringing us to some of his best spots. I just, you know, want to do it myself. And so it's always like, man, is this the year that I, you know, buckle up and spend a few hundred bucks in gas and food and go try it and maybe find something, maybe not. And then you kind of always push it off. But if you had a turkey tag and you're like, no, we're doing a turkey hunt. We're going to spend 5 days hunting turkeys. Hopefully we shoot them on the first day, and then we're going to shed hunt the rest of the time. You know what I mean? Like, it just seems like it's a better way to get into it.
And I'll tell you what, Merriams, they're fun to hunt too. They're just, they act a little bit different than the Easterns we have here in Iowa.
Are they smarter? They're fun to hunt.
No, I would say
they're perfect.
They just act different. I don't know how to explain it. Smarter is definitely not the word I would use, but.
Well, I don't want them to be smarter. Yeah. I want them to be, I think it'd be fun to spot and stock, ground pound with a bow, some Merriams. We see them shed hunting. Yeah. We've gone shed hunting in the West before, like North Dakota and stuff. And we, you know, you'll be driving along trailhead, come around a corner, and there's a whole bunch of turkeys right there. And you're like, man, this looks easy.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's easier to hunt them. So when we go out to Nebraska, we hunt this creek bottom, and it's got a few roost trees on it. And there's probably 100 to 150 birds that roost in those few trees every single night. And when you're sitting in the blind in the morning, they're just all going off. And yeah, it's a different experience in Iowa, because you don't see that many birds grouped up in one spot all together. And yeah, it's a fun hunt. We look forward to it every year.
Is that on public land? I don't need your spot. I'm just curious if there's that kind of turkey hunting potential on public.
We started on public ground and actually shot a few birds off it, and had a really good hunt. But then we just started knocking on doors when we were out there, and were able to, over the years, find a couple really good spots. And, you know, we good to the landowner, he's good to us, and we've been able to go back there for quite a few years now. And turkeys are always in the same spot every year when we go back out. So, yeah, we're on private. But, yeah, we started public out there, and we had just as good a hunt on public as we did private.
Interesting. We'll have to do that. Me and Abby will have to do that sometime. Maybe connect with you and say, hey, we're going out to Wyoming. We'll be right across the river, or get some Western turkeys and some elk sheds going.
I'd love to go even further west than South Dakota, Nebraska, and get out into Wyoming. And Wyoming's my favorite state by far to hunt. I don't know what it is about it, but I've been elk hunting out there. I've been antelope hunting, and yeah, I'd love to shoot turkeys out there too. It'd be a blast.
I'll have to get something lined up. But until then, I notice we're just over an hour already, which seems like time flies. But I really do appreciate you being here today, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, talking fun stuff. Give the listeners a chance to follow along with some of the stuff you've got going on, and blow up your inbox asking if you can mount everything under the sun for them.
Absolutely.
So it looks like Instagram, we'll put links in the comments, but we'll put some Instagram links for everyone to check out. All the got a lot of turkey stuff going, a lot of turkeys, a lot of big bucks.
That's,
so
that's just easy to post, and it seems like I always remember to post that stuff. I don't a lot of times when I'm freezing in my tree stand, I don't remember to get my phone out and post anything. So
yeah, fair
that's
enough.
Just the way that. Yep.
Fair enough. I don't do that either, but I do appreciate it. Appreciate you being here tonight, yep, sharing some stories, and I appreciate you guys listening along.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.